I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
It's hard to locate the precise cause of the epilepsy, but it's obviously an effect of the inflammation inside his brain. We can attack the symptoms, but the cause is incurable. I have to ask, do you know what that cause is?
No.
I'm afraid the infection exists because your son has AIDS.
The British television drama It's a Sin has reignited a discussion about the AIDS crisis. Written by Russell T. Davies, the show follows a group of friends living through the epidemic in London in the 1980s.
There are boys dying all over the world from sex.
Don't be ridiculous. That would be all over the news.
The government knows all about it and they're keeping it quiet.
Do you think there's an illness that only kills gay men?
The whole thing is a pack of lies.
It's really odd that this TV series has suddenly, it's like it's woken everybody up to it. And a lot of people are saying, you know, was it really that bad? Was it really that awful? We didn't know. And I think it clearly was in danger of being forgotten. And that makes me feel sad that it might be forgotten.
Lee Chisler worked at St Mary's Hospital in London on their HIV ward. Watching the show, he saw himself in the nurses caring for the patients, but also in the young gay men navigating their lives in London at the time.
What do you want to be doing?
What's the plan?
I just want to be happy. I want to learn everything.
I'll be stinking rich.
The bit when they were talking about their lives and their futures was really hard to hear because that really resonated, because I knew so many people who had no future.
Today, the AIDS epidemic and what it meant for gay rights. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of March.
Can we start with a little about your childhood?
Anushka Astana is editor-at-large for The Guardian and host of the podcast Today in Focus, where this episode first aired.
Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Coventry, but from the age of 8 or 9, I moved to a little village near Stratford-upon-Avon.
And what was it like there?
It was rural, narrow-minded, I guess. I didn't really know what gay was. I didn't understand what it was, but I knew I was different. And I know even teachers, I remember a teacher saying to me in front of the whole class, "What are you getting for Christmas, Chislet? A Cindy doll?" And everybody laughing. And it was humiliating. But I didn't understand what they meant. I didn't really have any examples of gay people. So the people I would see would be John Inman.
It's the masked stranger. Take my body, but leave my jewels alone.
Are you being served?
Good morning, Mr. Humphreys.
I withdraw the offer.
That's not really me. So I guess I was really confused. You know, I came from, you know, a family which was very macho as well. And I think in some way from an early age, although I don't have all terrible memories, I had some good friends at the time, I knew I had to get out of there. Something was making me think it was almost like I had to find my own people, my own tribe. And I hate tribalism, but that's what it felt like. I just had to go. I literally packed everything. I had my record player with me, my records, and I got on the coach and just went. I think I was 16, 17. That's quite young, isn't it?
Sounds extremely exciting. And tell me what you found. Tell me what it was like.
Yeah, well, it was exciting. You know, I was pretending that I was that I was heterosexual. You know, I mean, I think, you know, somebody later on said to me, "Lee, you was the only one who didn't know." but yeah, oh God, I love London. Oh my God, I loved it. When I started my nurse training, somebody said that along Parade Street at the time, there used to be, you know, adult shops, shall we say, and a cinema that showed, you know, like soft porn films. That one of the senior nurses said, you know, I do not want to see any of my nurses frequenting anywhere near those places. And, it was like, and she said, there is a place called Soho that is full of deviants. And of course, my heart was going, well, where's that? I can't wait. I remember I went to Soho and there was a place called the Piano Bar that was next to Madame Jojo's. And I remember really nervously walking into this little tiny piano bar. And inside there was trans people and rent boys and gays and something. And I thought, I just looked around and I thought, oh, I've found people who don't fit in like me. And that felt great, actually. I mean, it was probably a tatty little bar, but I just thought it was the most glamorous thing I'd ever seen.
Was it exciting being somewhere where people were more open about their sexuality?
It was liberating. It was liberating, but I also knew that it was a bit scary as well. If you think about it now, in my nursing set, there was 14, 15 in my nursing set, it was illegal for me to have sex. Everybody else could have sex, but because I was under 21, I wasn't allowed to. There was a different law for me.
Do you remember the first time you heard about HIV or AIDS?
I remember I was in a bar in Stratford. It wasn't an official gay bar, as a lot of gay men went. And there was these three older gay men at the bar. Somebody said, have you heard about these queens, these gays getting this cancer thing in America? Have you heard about it? And the older guy said, oh, don't worry. It's an American thing. It won't come here. But I was really aware that there was a bit of fear in the air. You sort of think, what's this?
This is Greenwich Village. Here, the killer disease has taken its greatest toll of death.
And of course, later on, there was a documentary around called Killer in the Village.
He has cancer because his immune system has broken down. And it's this underlying immune deficiency that others have called the gay plague. That name, with its hints of divine retribution for a despised and segregated minority, is not popular among gay men.
And I remember being really impacted by this programme.
The British gay community is no longer just watching on the sidelines. There have been deaths here too. AIDS has already arrived in Britain. Do we already have the hidden seeds of an epidemic here?
So you were aware of the virus when you moved to London. When did you first come across an AIDS patient in your work?
I was a student nurse and it wasn't HIV, it was just a general ward. And there was three cubicles in the corridor at the end. And somebody came in who had AIDS. He was a young guy. And I remember he had like this huge carposis sarcoma on his nose. And students weren't allowed to look after people with HIV at the time. And it got out on the ward that there was somebody with AIDS on the ward. And some of the families were ganging together and coming up and demanding that, even he was in a cubicle, was demanding that their families be moved from the ward, that they wanted them to go somewhere else. And the other thing is that really upset me, there was a little glass window in his door and people kept peeking in, like with their hands and looking in on him. And I went to the report that day, you know, the report is where you do a handover. And I was so angry, like blind anger and so upset. And I was the jokey, laughing nurse. So people, it was really unexpected from me. The senior nurse said to me, Lee, are you okay? And I just did this barrage and I said, you have treated that man like a circus animal or like a zoo animal rather. And I said, I've never felt so ashamed. And I would love to say that I was really brave, but I was so upset, I just burst into tears and ran out. When I finally caught up with the nurse, she asked me if I'd like to look after him. So I went to look after him and I couldn't get through to him at all. you know, and I was going into the room and I was going, oh, hi, how are you, you know? And, you know, and I think all the other, a lot of nurses have been wearing masks and that, but I knew that wasn't necessary because I'd seen the doctors in America. So I thought, well, that can't be right. They wouldn't put their lives at risk. And finally he had some food on his table in some tin foil. And I was going, just being a greedy pig, I was going, oh, God, that looks nice. That looks really lovely. And he asked me if I'd like some. And I went, I wasn't trying to prove a point at all. I just said, oh, yeah. I said, wouldn't mind that little one there, because you know, I was hungry. And then he got really emotional and started to cry. And I suddenly realised it's because somebody had accepted his food. And I just was so impacted and so moved by that, that was it. I was going to do something, you know. And so I used to go and badger them up on the HIV ward and said, I'm going to come and work here.
So you started on the HIV ward in 1988, and by that point, medical staff understood a lot more about the virus. What happened to people who contracted HIV?
Basically, your immune system used to collapse. A lot of us carry around, say, pneumonia in our lungs, but we just fight it off. And of course, their immune system would just completely go. So often people would come in and they would have these purple lesions called Kaposi's sarcomas that could be incredibly, incredibly disfiguring. They would often come in with pneumonia, PCP, and they would really, really struggle to breathe. And sometimes, you know, they could be sometimes dead within hours. There was a thing called cryptosporidium, where you would have litres and litres and litres of diarrhoea, and you would eventually, people would just literally fade away. People were losing their sight, they were dementing, they were getting horrible tumours. I mean, it was just ghastly.
Must have been a really hard environment to work in.
It was hard. You knew it was unlikely for most people you were going to get them better. Usually at the very beginning, once they were on the ward, they weren't going to leave it. I think what I learned very quickly, with this sounds very melodramatic and I'm not meaning it, anything I'd learned in nursing about giving medicines and that sort of thing, I suddenly realised that all I really had was me. And so sometimes it was just, I could see if I could help people die less scared. Often, particularly on night duty, people would spill their hearts and souls to you. You know, there was some families that were supportive, others weren't. Sometimes the parents just didn't want to know, which was tough as well, or found it difficult. The mums often would come in. Often they didn't even know their sons were gay, let alone. And of course, you've got this mysterious thing that everybody in the paper was condemning them for. It was really tough. Sometimes the dads would just stand there in absolute fear and they didn't know what to do. And I remember one dad pinned me against the wall. You know, he was going, please do something. And, you know.
At that time, was there anything you could do to treat them?
At the beginning, very little. You could control the pain, but people would have tried anything. And it's partly because of that is where we are today with the drugs. There was a guy who I knew quite well, and he was going to go on a drug trial. And this drug trial was not having great results. And I was going, well, I'm not sure about this drug trial. And he said to me, Lee, I'm going to die anyway. This is for the next lot.
Gosh.
Although I say all these stories that sound really sad, there was great fun and great. I've really got to put that in. They used to have me belly laughing sometimes because, you know, I was so young and naive. They used to love teasing me, and I'd take my little Walkman in and we'd listen to music together and that sort of thing. Lily Savage and Regina Fong coming to the Christmas parties. So there was also a lot of camaraderie and fun and a real bond between staff.
Tell me about the funerals. Did you go to a lot at the time, and what were they like?
You would go to one and, you know, it would be like, it would be, I am what I am, and And people would be laughing and joking and they'd be talking about their lives. And then sometimes, you know, I remember there was somebody whose family didn't want anybody at their funeral, but we went and sat in anyway. I'm thinking, I'm going anyway. You're going to have to throw me out. Some of the partners, like it showed in It's a Sin, were asked to sit at the back and they weren't really seen or even mentioned as part of the funeral, which was just terrible.
And was it tense sometimes?
Sometimes the families didn't know about their son's life. It was a big secret. They didn't realise they were gay. So there's all these gay people, you know, sometimes like in leather and handlebar moustaches. And we're like, oh my God, it's like a different world to them. So it must have been a little bit of a shock. But also it got to the point where you think, I can't go to another one. I can't bear it. You know, and then you felt guilty about not being able to bear it.
You spoke earlier about the shame you had about your own sexuality. What did you learn about yourself being on that ward?
So one of the things that, you know, I was talking earlier about the homophobia, not long after being there was a guy on the ward. He was dying. He was literally skin and bone. And he really could hardly move. And his partner would be sitting with him. And he was a great big guy. And he would not leave his side for 1 minute. He'd ring the buzzer and say, Lee, I'm just going to the bathroom. You must promise me you must sit with him. And he would get this little pink sponge and just slowly clean his teeth. And he, you know, it's OK, honey, it's OK. Do you know something? What I learned from that is I realised that gay men could love each other. And not only could they love each other, is that I'd never, ever seen love like it. And of course, nobody had ever taught me that. So it's a brutal way to learn. That's when I vowed that I came out of that closet with a vengeance. It's like, I'm never going to be ashamed again.
Wow.
There is now a danger that has become a threat to us all. It is a deadly disease and there is no known cure. The virus can be passed during sexual intercourse with an infected person. Anyone can get it, man or woman. So far, it's been confined to small groups, but it's spreading. So protect yourself.
You started on the ward after the government's Don't Die of Ignorance campaign.
If you ignore AIDS, it could be the death of you. So don't die of ignorance.
What did you make of the media coverage about HIV at the time?
Well, interestingly, the campaign itself, it was fascinating when looking back because it actually did its job in a way that it really reduced sexually transmitted infections. We saw them plummet, but what it did, it made people scared. And when people are scared, they attack. And they want to blame. And that's what happened. And if you're asking me about the media, it was sadistic. There's no other word. It was sadistic. I remember this was in a national newspaper, a vicar, and he's got a shotgun to his son's head, who's on his knees looking up at his dad. And it said, I will shoot my son if he gets AIDS. Every week it was the scourge of the 80s, and they would do these things like 60% of people say gay people should be isolated or people with AIDS should be isolated. 50% said they should be sterilised, go figure. Or the leader of Manchester Police, it's a cesspool of their own making. We have absolutely no sympathy for them. It was like kicking a bruise. You can see I'm still angry about it now.
I mean, how did it impact on patients seeing headlines like that?
Well, it was tough. It was tough because they were made to feel that it was their fault. I mean, can you imagine now if somebody had a gun, somebody said, saying, you know, you've got COVID, that I'm going to shoot you. I mean, it was hate. And what people had done, it knocked us back 50 years. They'd found something to hang their prejudice on. And, oh, my God, they went for it. Journalists would come with flowers and, you know, we used to have people who were well-known at the time and they'd say, oh, can you give these to so-and-so? And you'd say, oh, thank you. And they'd say, oh, so you can confirm they're on the ward now. Margaret Thatcher at the time was basically saying that we were pretend.
Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life. Yes, cheated.
They brought out this clause 28 where you couldn't promote homosexuality. What a cruel thing to do. What all these young guys were dying, and you added shame onto them, you added guilt. But what was brilliant, and this was another thing I learned, is that I saw these young men galvanize and fight back. Even on Pride, we would take people in their wheelchairs.
Was there a sense that the government was neglecting this?
In many ways, AIDS was allowed to happen. You can hear footage of the government in America, and they're talking about these young men dying, and they're laughing. Oh, were you one of those then? Are you going to get it? And they're laughing. There was a potential they could have stopped it in its tracks, potentially, or certainly slowed it down. Britain, we were very lucky in one way because we had the NHS. Even though the government of the day were hostile, Norman Fowler, he'd gone to America and seen what was happening. He did all he could to persuade the government at the time to do something.
You talked about how AIDS galvanised the gay community. Tell me about what people did.
This was a community who came together. You know, they formed Body Positive, THT, Frontliners, Switchboard. There was a fight to make the medications come out quickly. AIDS actually brought the gay cause on in a lot of other ways as well.
Good evening, the headlines at 6 o'clock. In the House of Lords, a vote is taking place now on a challenge to the poll tax.
A lot of the lesbian women, oh, wow, they were fighting. They fought back with us. They were brilliant.
And I do apologise if you're hearing quite a lot of noise in this studio at the moment. I'm afraid that we have rather been invaded by some people who we hope to be removed.
And there is people like Peter Tatchell.
We want to draw attention to the government, the fact that Britain has more anti-gay laws than any other West European country.
Jimmy Somerville.
And there we are. That was Jimmy on tape. Here's Jimmy live. Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a record that's actually already doing well in the charts, but there are a number of people who won't play it.
I think maybe it's got a lot to do with the content of the song and what the song...
Well, the fact that it's about somebody who died of AIDS.
From AIDS. So if they don't play it, it means then they don't have to actually discuss it or they don't actually have to talk about it.
And those ones in America.
We are being allowed to die while low-risk populations are being panicked, not educated, panicked, into believing that we deserve to die.
We are where we are today because of activists. Somebody said to me, I went to this talk and they said, the trouble is LGBT people have no heroes. I'm like, are you mad? Are you mad you have no heroes? Look at these people. They should have statues built to them. They save thousands of people's lives with their protesting.
I know you eventually left the ward. Why was that?
My last night shift on the ward. Three people had died on the one night shift. I looked at my friend and said, I can't keep putting myself through it. I can't keep doing it. And I felt really guilty about that. So I carried on doing it, but I did it in an outpatient and a daycare. But actually just seeing that those young guys die all the time became too much.
Next, 30 years after leaving the HIV ward, Lee now manages the sexual health clinic at 56 Dean Street, just a few minutes' walk from the piano bar he walked into in his early 20s.
One of the things I felt when I was watching It's a Sin, and I think like everyone else I know who watched it, I was sobbing, shaking by the end of it because it was just so heartbreaking. Mm. But it also made me think about what's happened since. I remember thinking, as people did back then, that HIV felt like a death sentence, but it certainly doesn't now. When did we get effective treatment for HIV?
So the first time, I think it was around 1996, that it became effective. I mean, that was like, you know, I had this idea when that day would happen that there'd be street parties, but it never quite happened like that. It sort of came in. And I remember seeing a young guy and he had a Kaposi's sarcoma in his mouth. And of course, in my day, that would have been it. You know what I mean? You would have, you know, he took the treatment and I saw him. This was later on and it had just melted away and he was well again. Can you imagine?
God, no. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. All these people we thought were going to die suddenly became well again. It was a miracle. Oh, it was a miracle. People fought hard for it. And now, if you're HIV positive and you're diagnosed early enough, you are going to live a full life. You're going to live a full lifespan. You know, we have got something called PrEP now that can stop you becoming HIV positive. I mean, the other remarkable thing is you can have unprotected sex with somebody who's HIV positive. They're on treatment. You can't get it.
It's amazing.
And yet what really disappoints me, and it's getting better, but there's still stigma. So psychologically, we haven't come on at the same pace as medicine. You know, you don't go, I need to tell you I've got diabetes. You know what I mean? It's just, so there's something about, you know, so that I find really disappointing. But there are people now, and I'm not saying this is for everybody, you know, like Harvey Milk used to say, the more people who come out as gay, and it's your cousins, your brothers, your friends, the less it will become stigmatized. And I think that's probably going to be the way with HIV.
And obviously this miracle treatment is readily available in a country like the UK, but is that the case all around the world?
No. So when I'm talking about these things, obviously I'm talking them from a very Western viewpoint. There are places where this treatment is still not available. Have we come a long way? Yes. But is the fight over? No. There are still places where getting HIV tests is not easy. We're getting treatment is not easy. You know, in some countries there are still people dying from HIV, and that should never be allowed to happen.
And many people have died. We should say that this crisis went far beyond the gay community, who were initially so disproportionately impacted. Over 33 million men and women globally have lost their lives. You said at the beginning of this interview about your worry that without talking about what happened at the time, it will be forgotten. Do you think there is a lack of education about what happened to the gay community in the 1980s?
The education is an absolute disgrace. And I think part of that even comes down from that clause 28. You know, I think that the remnants of that still creep through. But yeah, that for God to educate. I mean, what is taught about gay history anywhere? You know, I talk to young gay men. Does anybody know that thousands of gay men were killed in concentration camps in the Holocaust? No. Did they know that, you know, I mean, I was really shocked that people didn't know this history. I thought people knew it. I got quite shocked that people didn't know about it. I was going, what do you mean you didn't know? A young guy who was 18, he literally was like crying on my shoulder going, you know, why did nobody tell me? Why didn't I know about this? You know, and so that was very moving.
Looking back now, how did the AIDS epidemic affect the gay community and gay rights movement in the decades that followed?
I know this might sound strange to people, but AIDS was one of our proudest moments. Bizarrely, it was brutal, it was cruel, but it brought things on. It brought things on. I don't think without the fight for with AIDS, we would have gay marriage. I don't think without the fight for AIDS, we would have the age of consent. Because that's what happened when we got angry and we said we're not putting up with anymore. We realised that we have got every right to be who we are as anybody. And going back to that guy who was with his partner, their love was as good as anything I'd ever seen.
Lee, Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for listening to my story and for remembering those guys.
When I look back upon my life, it's always with a sense of shame. I've always been the one to blame. For everything I long to do, no matter when or where or who.
That's it for today. If you haven't watched the show yet, in Australia, you can stream It's a Sin now on Stan. And right now you're listening to a cover of the Pet Shop Boys' It's a Sin, performed by Years and Years. Their singer, Ollie Alexander, portrays Richie Tozer in the show. This episode first aired on Today in Focus, our global news podcast made by the Guardian team in London. If you liked this episode, you can check out Today in Focus on the Guardian website or subscribe by searching for Today in Focus on whatever app you get your podcasts on. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Casson and Reece Dora. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. Additional production by Joe Koning. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Okay, catch you tomorrow.